Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning into the conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, December 3rd. We take a closer look at the free bus service on the island of Hawaii. It was recently extended, but how long will it remain free? Tomorrow marks a month since a fatal UPS plane crash in Kentucky that was en route to Hawaii. Was your mail or package on that flight? We consider the Postal Service as we get a slice of life from Small Business Saturday. There's a new film festival on Maui. We talked to the Valley Isles Film Commissioner about the call for submissions. And we meet a coastal foraging bird with a rattling call on this week's Manu Minute. Plus, we share a snail conservation success story and introduce you to two driving forces behind a new exhibit at the Honolulu Zoo that opened this month. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii County has been providing free bus service to riders since the COVID pandemic, which has boosted ridership dramatically. But now the county is looking to divert funding for public transit to affordable housing. And that worries transportation officials. With the transit department losing some of their main source of revenue, can they really afford to keep offering free bus service? Here to talk about that is HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, I just think that's amazing that they have free bus service.
Yeah, it's an amazing program. It's been in place since 2022, and it was initially funded through emergency funds during the COVID pandemic. It was supposed to end this month, but they were able to extend it. And it's interesting because it's coming at a time in which, big picture, the Hawaii County public transportation budget is facing this uncertainty. It's about $59 million that they're spending to offer free buses and paratransit services, not just free buses and paratransit services, but everything to the public. And most of the money that goes to Hawaii County's transit comes from the general excise tax surcharge. And the Hawaii County Council actually this year passed a measure to divert some of those funds to yet-to-be-determined affordable housing ventures. And that could hamper mass transit's budget, says the agency administrator, Zach Birdman.
We definitely don't want to lose GET. We don't really want to, you know, have to cut back services to the community. We would definitely like to continue where we're at, but also, you know, continue to grow, because that's what it's all about.
So how do they plan to do that?
Well, when we're looking just at free services, the question I had was whether or not, okay, if we're going to lose some funds through GET, that is yet to be determined again, would perhaps some of the funding that we would get through fares fill in that gap? And Zach Birdman basically said no. You know, we might think of fares as the main way that you fund the bus. It makes sense because that's the way we interact with the bus. You get on, you pay your $2, $3. For Hawaii County, it was $2 before they stopped charging fare for their fixed routes. But that constitutes a very small amount of the bus's budget. So when you look at Hawaii County specifically, they were in a low point of ridership in 2021. That was the last full year that they charged fares. Only 325,000 people were taking the bus at that time. It's now about three times that. So the program has been really successful in increasing ridership. But at that low point, they made just $376,000 in fares, which Burgum says that amount of revenue would barely make a dent in the department's expenses.
But doesn't that, like, you know, every little bit helps, right? I mean, doesn't that offset it?
Well, when you consider their expenses, so for instance, what they pay in fuel is three times what they would make in fares. And they may make more now than they did in 2021 when they're at that low point of ridership. But Burgum estimates that if they started charging fares tomorrow, revenue would still be quite slim. He thinks it would be about $750,000, which is only equivalent to 1% of Hawaii County's mass transit budget. And ironically, at least at the outset, it might be more expensive for the agency to charge fares than to keep the bus free, because there's software that they need to install and fare boxes that they need to install in their fleet so that people can actually pay for the bus using methods like card or mobile apps, not just change. And Burgum told the Hawaii County Council that he expects that that would cost over $1 million, which is more than what he estimates revenue would be over a year period. And, you know, when Burgum steps back and looks at this, he just says transit on a whole is not a money-making business. He really sees it as a service for the community. But during the agency's budget hearings this year, some lawmakers have questioned whether that service is worth the cost. And that cost has skyrocketed in recent years. Mass Transit's budget has gone up 400% since 2018. Here's Council Member Heather Kimball. She represents Hilo and Hamakua Coast, and she was talking during those meetings weighing this.
I love Mass Transit. Like, anytime I go to a big city, I am all about riding the subway or the bus or whatever, because it's awesome. But I tried to say, I'm going to support Mass Transit, and I'm going to go from my house to my office, which is 10 miles down the road. It was going to take me 2 hours to get here because I had to, like, ride up and then wait for the bus there and then ride back down. And I know that in my district, the bus is critical because so many of the folks in my district work in the hotels. And I know that those buses are, like, standing room only. And then we have a whole other population that just can't even get to the bus stops because they're way out there in the middle of nowhere. And so, you know, as much as I would like to say, the story nationally is, in order for mass transit to work, you just got to throw money at it and build it and make it really easy and accessible. But there's a point where you got to, like, okay, just say, this isn't working, we got to cut and pivot.
Interesting.
And I actually followed up also more recently with Councilmember James Hustis. He's the chair of Public Works and Mass Transit Committee, and he supports expanding the bus service, but he also says they're hearing from the community that there's a real need for public housing. And he voted in favor of the measure to divert some of the funding from mass transit to housing initiatives. Here's what he had to say.
I think we're kind of touching that ceiling right now in terms of what we can afford, and there will be definitely challenges and changes to use those that general excise tax that we rely upon for mass transit, especially if we are serious about developing communities and investing in infrastructure needed to grow community, to help with housing development, to build out our urban centers. Some of that may be shifted away from mass transit. So it will be a challenge for mass transit going forward in terms of what we can achieve with the dollars we have and where we need to redirect some of that as well.
So how do they plan to respond to these pressures?
So Zach Bergman said he's being conscious about not dipping too deeply into the county's coffers. For the next fiscal year, they're not anticipating any increases in the bus budget, in the mass transit budget. And he's also trying to get creative with other places where they can fund big projects. So microtransit, as well as new all-electric buses, they recently put 4 new all-electric buses into operation on routes on Hawaii Island. A lot of those projects are being supported by state and federal level funds. That includes this free service that is offered. So pandemic era funds ended, but they were able to pursue federal formula funds to support that through 2028. The Department of Transportation, because it wants to see fewer people driving on cars and more people on buses, they're making investments on Hawaii Island. So he's trying to get as creative as possible to make sure that this is a service that works for people while being efficient with county funds.
Yeah, well, it sounds like, though, they're going to have to make some, you know, hard decisions, right? Short-term costs, long-term gain, and you know, providing the service for the future.
Certainly.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HBR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Saturday night on The Real Deal, we'll be celebrating the birthday of Dave Brubeck, the pianist and band leader. Join me, Seth Marco, from 8 to 10 Saturday night on member-supported HPR One as we celebrate the one and only Dave Brubeck.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
You know, tomorrow marks a month since the crash of a UPS flight from Kentucky to Honolulu, which killed 14 people. The Federal Aviation Administration ordered the grounding of the type of cargo jet that crashed during takeoff. MD-11s make up 9% of the UPS fleet, and the U.S. Postal System and UPS haven't released much information about the mail and packages that were on board the flight. USPS depends on companies like UPS to transport its mail to Hawaii. It's been telling its customers to check its website on how to file claims or track their packages. Managers say, though, some business customers were expecting hundreds of packages and fear the worst. It's unclear what impact that the grounding of similar planes with UPS and FedEx could have on holiday deliveries, though the Postal Service says it's more than ready to handle the volume this holiday season. This past weekend, the focus was on supporting small businesses, some of which might be affected by the reduced shipping fleet. In Kaimuki, Small Business Saturday is traditionally a big draw for what has become a hipster neighborhood with lots of boutiques and local eateries. HPR was there this weekend as longtime postal carrier Jim Finnegan was preparing to make a delivery to Red Pineapple, a small shop at the top of the hill, which depends on the service. Finnegan is a familiar face in the neighborhood. He's worked for the Postal Service for 30 years.
This route has been my route for the last 7 years now.
And so explain to our listeners what's involved in a day.
In a day in the life of the letter carrier, essentially is after you've clocked in, you'll go inspect your vehicle and ensure that it's safe and in working order. After that, you'll go and collect the day's mail and take it to your case. You'll sort the mail, check that case one more time as far as outgoing mail, pull down your mail, return any missorted mail, get your vehicle, and then you'll load up the mail and parcels and then depart for your route. And there you just go through your right, whether it's a driving route or it's a, what they call a park and loop, where you park at a spot and loop it around. And that's your day.
So a typical day to day, how many packages are you delivering?
Today that I know of, what my scanner will tell me, the ones that have a barcode, and today I have 116.
Is that average?
No, usually it's increasing because we're going into what we call peak season, the holiday season. I could say mine will be more closer to 70.
Got a little bit heavy lift today.
Yes.
We're in Kaimuki. I mean, this is a lot of small businesses in this community. This has been my community for 40 plus years, but it's just a neat neighborhood.
I have business and residential, and the people out here are just absolutely wonderful, kind and caring and giving. Absolutely true. They make my day.
And so what do people need to know during this holiday season?
The big question usually is the drop-dead deadline, which would be basically if you're mailing anywhere to the mainland, ground first class would be December 17th, priority is December 18th, and if you're mailing express, no later than the 20th December. Now, if you go international, the drop-dead deadline would be December 9th for first class, December 9th also for priority, and December 16th for priority express.
And then has anything changed? Because it's been, oh gosh, more than a year now since Amazon got into this market. Has it changed your route or your lift on an average day?
Oh, absolutely. Last year was the first year with Amazon here in Hawaii just started delivering their parcels. And from that point, there was a significant drop in the parcel load. which made our routes, what we would say, lighter. It did take us less time. So we did, which has always gone all across the U.S., a route review, and we consolidated a few routes to make it geographically longer, to make them 8 hours.
I know a carrier in my neighborhood, he says sometimes on Sunday, he does more than 200. It's just been a crazy kind of lift.
Yes, up until last year, 200 was not an unusual number.
Right, the pandemic. I guess everybody's ordering online, and yes. And it just was nuts.
The genie left the bottle when the pandemic hit. In all my time, there's always been what I call the wave, an afterflow, and it usually continued on as far as parcels and mail to about mid-January, and it went back to normal levels. That first year of COVID, that first wave didn't end until the end of March. It's definitely changed how they shop and how they order.
And then this morning, we're here in Kaimuki, and I don't know, for small businesses, how common is it that you have multiple packages that you deliver every day?
Actually, quite common. We prefer that they schedule, go online to USPS.com and schedule a pickup. That we help our manage our time and our overtime and watch our budget. But nonetheless, we'll pick up the parcels. So as far as my route, I can have as many as 6-7 pickups in one day.
And then what about deliveries? Like a small business like this has lots of merchandise coming from all over the place.
Oh, absolutely. We will pick up and deliver to the small business as well as we do with our residential.
Okay, but same type of thing, it's scheduled?
As far as a delivery?
Yeah.
No, whoever's mailed it, it's coming just like your letter mail, right. So it'll be just delivered.
Okay. Anything else that you get one underscore just from the Postal Service point of view?
The only other thing I could think of is package security. When you mail your package, try to make sure your package is in the box is an appropriate size, not too big, not too small, the Goldilocks. Pack it with paper and some bubble wrap. Don't use string to tie it. Make an additional paper and put it inside your box with the return address and the shipping address, just in case the label outside got damaged. Tape it up and then make sure it's secured all the way around.
Okay, because it does happen.
It does happen, unfortunately, either from weather or maybe a machine, but yes. So sometimes that label can come off and then we try and figure it out and it goes to the postal inspectors and they're the ones who can open it up. And if it has the return address and a shipping, they know they can continue on.
Good tip. I don't do that, but maybe I should. All right. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thank you for the questions. I appreciate your time.
And Eleni McLaughlin is the owner of Red Pineapple, whose gift shop also offers custom gift baskets for its customers.
Small Business Saturday is everything. Keep It Kaimuki is everything for us. It is a huge marker in how well your business is doing for the year. So we're super excited to have the community come out in droves, as you probably have been seeing the people in and out of our doors. So we love having the community come in and out of our doors. And part of the service we offer is mailing packages. We have locally made goods that we mail all year round. And most of the product we mail out are made here, made on all of the islands, including Lanai and Molokai. So we have things coming from every island into our store and we ship it out. So it's really part of the lifeblood of our business to be able to ship things to the mainland and all over the world. And we find the post office super convenient. As you saw, Jim, our postal carrier, is amazing. And we love that he picks up right at our door. We don't have to run around or drive it somewhere. The prices are the most reasonable. They recently started doing a Advantage shipping, which is even cheaper than Priority. So we have so many options of levels of how we can ship things. But we just love the idea of using the post office. It's convenient, it's easy, the price makes sense. And then we have a nice carrier that comes and sees us every day. I don't know how else we would get our stuff around the world if we didn't have the post office. And their website is so convenient and easy. We can just print with a regular printer. We don't need a weird label system. It's just very user friendly, which is why we use it. So any of my staff can print and stick a label on a box. So it's just ease of use for us, for sure. And prices, it's very reasonably priced.
How many deliveries do you get, let's say, in an average week? Because you have merchandise that comes from all over.
I do. So we see our postal carrier every day, and we can get 40 boxes in a day. We can fill the entire Priority truck with merchandise coming in because we get packages from all the outer islands from merchandise coming in, and then we do mail out a good amount. But it's any given day, there's either one package or 25, so it just depends on the day. But we're busy bees.
Tis the season.
Yes, tis the season.
And McLaughlin and Finnegan consider themselves Santa's helpers as they get gifts to their destination during this very busy season. And a reminder to make sure you get those holiday gifts to its intended recipient. Get them out well before the mail deadlines. Look for links on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, with works from around the globe spanning 5,000 years, offering fresh discoveries and new perspectives. HonoluluMuseum.org.
There have been 21 boat strikes. 83 people have been killed. And if it's not an armed conflict, even if Trump says he's determined that it is one, then all 83 of those killings were arguably just murder.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
You know, we've heard from many of you following our two recent call-in shows about water usage on Maui and the future of golf in the state. Here's what one listener from Kihei had to say.
My name's John, and I live in Kihei 20-plus years. And I was listening to the radio while I was driving, and they were talking about the water shortage on the west side, east side of Maui. And I don't understand why no one has talked about desalinization plants. From what I understand, Alyssan was going to build one on Lanai, but they wanted to take 80% of the water after he built it. They weren't going to help him. But that'll solve all the problems. And then the golf courses can do their thing and the farmers can do their thing, and there's plenty of water for them, and the desalinization would go for the, you know, construction and the new homes or the old homes or whatever.
And we also heard from a listener over email who wrote, tourism is down, especially on Maui, as we try to recover from the fires. It's important to have a balanced amount of tourism, but it seems losing the Century PGA Tour event at Kapalua is a major fail for the state. How can we provide water for both the residents rebuilding and the golf course at the same time? We don't have time to wait. And Dita wrote in to say, a whole show on golf? At first, I was just aghast. But the longer I listened to the show, the more and more disgusted I became. Using drinking water so a few rich people can drive around in golf carts, making deals, how the people can be better exploited. Are you promoting the joys of the ruling class over the needs of the people? And finally, we received this voicemail from Sharon Atkinson from Lahaina.
I had a comment for the gentleman who was leading the talk about the golf courses. I think that if we want to have local support for golf courses, we need to involve more local people. I lived here on Maui, but I see the huge golf courses, but we don't have a par 3 golf course. I think if we had a smaller golf course, teachers could bring their class once in a while and have a PE golf day. Families, it wouldn't be so expensive. Families could maybe bring their kids. People could learn the game and maybe make it more, just make it more accessible to locals and to young people, and grow the sport on the islands that way.
We do appreciate your feedback. If you have a comment to share, leave a voicemail on our talkback line. That number is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The Maui Film Commission recently announced the creation of the Wailuku Film Festival. It comes in the wake of the Maui Film Festival closing up shop and filing for bankruptcy in May. The new festival in Wailuku is set for next June, and organizers are now accepting entries in four categories: Hawaiian storytelling, indigenous voices, water sports, and student filmmaking. The Conversation CW gives some talk with Maui Film Commissioner Brian Cohen about the new festival, as well as other pressing issues, including tax credits for the industry.
So the festival is going to establish this walkable gathering place for makers, primarily makers throughout Hawaii, but also the rest of the world. The categories: Hawaii, indigenous, water sports, and student. So being an educator myself, I see this need for a festival that students can be a legitimate part of. For 3-4 days, not only can they share their own work, they can experience the work of others and other students and interact directly with people in the industry. All of us, we've all been given a hand along the way. And so everybody in the entertainment industry, I believe most everybody, will talk about how important it is to help the next generation. So we're looking to provide that environment.
And these categories you enumerated: Hawaii, indigenous voices, water sports, student filmmakers. Talk a little bit about how you and your colleagues came to that framework.
Well, I'm a Hawaii filmmaker, so there's a selfish component here that I want to see my brothers and sisters who strive and have for so long being given a proper format that focuses on them. And hopefully we can tie other things together. And over time, the festival becomes a place that can connect up-and-coming makers to distribution, for example, or at least the education about what they face. Most strivey filmmakers in Hawaii and beyond, you know, it's enough to just do what we think we know what to do or how to do, is make a film and have a piece of art that's compelling and engaging and worthy of even screening. But most don't know nothing about what they face the day after that. And so we want to work to address that. So that's a big part of it. And I would also add about the Hawaii category is it's very broad. Is the film made in Hawaii? Is it about Hawaii? Is it somebody from Hawaii? Our brothers and sisters are all over the world making movies and participating. We never see these things. Our kids are going to Chapman and USC and UCLA and film schools all over the world. And I've never once seen one of these graduate projects come home and be honored. So that's a big part of why that Hawaii category is so broad. I would say the indigenous category is pretty obvious. From the Kanaka Maoli standpoint, we want to see these films and these filmmakers have a voice. But I think that these indigenous filmmakers the world over, New Zealand, for example, we want to bring these personalities in. These are the people who have found a way to use their indigenous voices and embed their values into industry and process. So if we can bring these people in to not only share their work and inspire us on that level, if they can help us understand how they operate elsewhere, because for too long, Hawaii filmmakers have tried to replicate the Hollywood system. And this might explain one reason why the moment Hollywood pulls up their tent and leaves, we're on our back. So we can build it. I've always said that. I'll say it until I'm dead, that we can do this on our own and we can do it based in our own values. So that's the indigenous category. Water sports, well, obviously we have personalities throughout the state that are at the top of that food chain. Laird Hamilton, Kai Lenny, and the list goes on. But what a lot of people don't realize is these people are filmmakers. So we want to establish a film festival here that could, over time, become the definitive water sports film festival in all of the Pacific, if not the world. And we'll be building out that category in partnership with these filmmakers. What do they want? What would serve them? How can they have a voice? Lastly, student. Again, very selfish on my part, I think, because I'm an educator. We have students up and coming. And what is missing? A film festival is missing. We have Hawaii International Film Festival. They're doing a wonderful job. They have a student component. They feature a lot of Hawaii work, and I love them. We are complementary to the Hawaii International Film Festival. And this student section, we want to get really serious. We want to fly these people in. We want them to hang out for 3-4 days, not only showing their own work, but we want them going to trainings, panels, workshops. We want them hanging out and being in the company of established filmmakers who can maybe offer them work, maybe collaborate in the future, but at the end of the day, inspire. And it's not a one-way street. I can tell you this much. Whenever I meet a young striver who's just trying to get in the game, and I meet a lot of them they inspire me. I forget, because I get beaten down by the industry and the business, I forget that at the end of the day, I'm a storyteller, and I always have been, and that gleam in my eye that has fueled me forever and helped me get through the darkest chapters of the 45-year adventure I've had in the industry. Well, whenever I get to work with these young strivers that may not see it coming, I want to re-up. I want to enlist. Sign me up. And furthermore, I'll help you. I'll work on your project. What do you want? What do you need? And so those are the categories and those are the whys. And we're just all very excited. And we feel that this serves a need in Hawaii.
And it sounds like from your earlier description of all that might be going on for the festival, it's not just about an opportunity to present work to the public, but it's also about workshops you mentioned and creating intersections professionally.
Absolutely. You know, some of our partners, the Screen Actors Guild, SAG, we're working with them. We're going to create workshops for up-and-coming actors, not only to find out how they can become part of that guild someday, but to get high-level professional training. And we've got a lot of SAG members statewide who want to give back. So we'll create that climate for those actors. If you ever had an interest in this industry, of meeting with the people who do it, anybody in the industry, especially at my level where we hire and we're putting teams together all the time, will tell you that a lot of the best workers in the film industry come from construction, because they have a work ethic. They have a strong back. They're not going to blink when you're working and you're grinding, because this type of work is not for everybody. And so here in Hawaii, I think a lot of people don't realize there's a seat at the table for you. And so Wailuku Film Festival will hopefully be one component to find your way forward and to meet the people who hire and inspire and want to help you.
Well, the state legislature will come back into session in the new year. Any legislative priorities from your perspective as the film commissioner? I know tax incentives have been an issue in the past.
Yeah. Our incentive, I would say, is 22% production rebate on Oahu and 27% elsewhere. It's competitive, but not really if you consider that Hawaii competes with countries. Even New Zealand today announced that they're increasing their production incentives. So Hawaii's behind the curve on this. The last couple of years, the indifference, I would say, I'm not going to refer to hostility, though that was there too, but the indifference towards our industry, as though there's some other industry here that's green and an option to tourism. Well, we've got to step up. Governmental leaders and the legislature have got to put their money where their mouth is, and they see us now. So I'm very hopeful, I would say. I would say that this coming session, the importance is for all of us with an interest, the people in the industry, the guilds, the unions, the film offices, we all have to, and we are, working to speak with one voice. This last session, there were so many voices that even the politicians that were sensitive and supportive of our causes were confused, because they were hearing contradictory requests. What's important is the film production incentive has to be increased straight up. We have to improve the incentive. I would love to see an additional uplift directly tied to local hires, because that's very important, and that goes a long way towards giving you and me and her and our neighbors a chance at those fatter roles when the outsiders come in. We have to incentivize them to help level us up also. So I am very hopeful, and I think it is very clear those two things are vital. Personally, I'd also, because I'm so hopeful, I'm an optimist, I think the extra work we have to be doing is anticipating that we are about to have a victory. So if that indeed happens, let's not get to April and May, throw a party, and then say, what's next? So we should be actively anticipating that we are about to get a boost, and that, I mean, as an aside, I would say, in an election year, especially on the after Chief of War and this amazing storytelling that we all are lamenting, why was not more of it shot in Hawaii? We know this. It's because of the business side. It's a business. We couldn't compete. Well, I probably wouldn't want to be that politician that's hostile, let alone indifferent to this industry, because there's a lot of voices and people in Hawaii are now right on the front lines. It's not going to take a lot to unseat a hostile politician to our industry. I really don't believe so. So I think that they're going to do the right thing, whether they want to or not. And we're going to have this new opportunity. And I want to wake up on May 1st and get to work on the plan that I have for how I can bring more activity to Hawaii. more activity to Maui, and I want to have a plan on how I'm going to get more Hawaii residents in creative roles and working again. That's my vision.
That was Brian Cohn, Maui Film Commissioner, speaking with HBR's D.W. Gibson about the newly announced Wailuku Film Festival. For more information, including how to submit a film, check out our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Department of Transportation, wishing all a safe holiday season by planning to have a designated driver for parties and events. HIDOT.hawaii.gov.
When the right to abortion was lost in Alabama, people needed help getting out of state. But offering support meant risking jail time.
Having the threat of being imprisoned for getting people to care completely changed everything.
The state threatens to prosecute anyone who helps abortion seekers.
What we saw in Alabama was something we hadn't seen in other states.
On the next Reveal.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific Health. Straub Benioff Medical Center's urgent care clinics are committed to providing care for minor illnesses and injuries. HawaiiPacificHealth.org/urgent care.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now to go to this week's Manu Minute. Hawaii's native sandpiper, or akakeke, with calls from the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology and Xenocanto. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Akakeke, also known as ready turnstones when you're not in Hawaii, are medium-sized sandpipers. They're about the size of a mynah bird. You can often see them foraging in small flocks, usually along rocky shorelines, but also in mudflats, fields, and lawns. Our birds in Hawaii are in their drab winter plumage, which includes mottled brown backs and white breasts, with a very noticeable black bib pattern below their chin. Their bright orange legs set them apart from other shorebirds you might see. Also, if you look closely, you can see a slight upturn in their bills, which, as their English name implies, seems to help them turn over stones in search of insects and crustaceans. Their Hawaiian name, akakeke, is similar to their call, which sounds a bit like kekekeke. See if you agree. By late April and May, you might notice that most akakeke have molted into their breeding plumage, so they can be more attractive to the opposite sex. They have a beautiful black and ruddy or red-brown pattern of feathers on their backs, and striking black and white patterns on their face and breast. Our akakeke make a non-stop migration across the northern Pacific to Alaska, a flight which likely takes them 3 to 4 days. Like many shorebirds, they spend the summer on breeding grounds high up in the Arctic to take advantage of abundant food resources during the long Arctic summers. The males and females arrive at about the same time, set up very exclusive territories in the tundra to keep out other akakeke, and they build their nest in a scrape on the ground. Both parents feed and care for up to 4 keiki in the nest, and if resources that summer are good, and they manage to escape predation by foxes or jaegers, the juveniles will get together in small flocks to make their first trip to Hawaii by late August, with most adults arriving a week or two before that. Our akakeke are considered to be an indigenous species, meaning that they're found naturally here as well as other parts of the world. The worldwide population size was recently estimated to be about 500,000 birds, and unlike many of our other native bird species, populations of akakeke appear to be relatively stable. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering guided nature adventures on Hawaii Island, designed to help inspire connection and stewardship of the land. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
The Honolulu Zoo opened a new snail laboratory at the Children's Petting Zoo this month. The new lab showcases a species of Oahu snail that are believed to be extinct in the wild. They were last seen in 2018. But today, we are hailing a conservation success story. Thanks to a University of Hawaii professor and one of his students, the work to save our native snails is continuing. We tip our hats to Mike Hatfield, who still works as a biologist at the Kualo Marine Lab. While he was working Monday to Friday with marine life, on the weekends, he spent time up Mauka in the forest collecting native snails. The student we mentioned was Hatfield's last PhD candidate, who is now with the Department of Land and Natural Resources. Wildlife biologist David Sisko is toiling to give our endangered snails a fighting chance to survive in a changing landscape with so many predators and threats to their native forests. Sisko, who runs the state's Snail Extinction Prevention Program, starts us off.
This is part of a partnership effort between the Department of Land and Natural Resources Snail Extinction Prevention Program with the Honolulu Zoo and the Bishop Museum. It's a captive rearing collective to help save our snails from extinction.
And we're highlighting a really cool success story. I mean, I know we're the extinction capital of the world, and it seems like it's a race against time, but there are some successes, and you guys want to shout about it.
We are having some successes, yeah. And the first tree snail species, the federally listed endangered tree snail species that's been given to the zoo, is Akatanella lila. It's a beautiful species from Oahu, from the northern Ko'ola Mountains. And as far as we know, it went extinct in 2018 in the wild. And so the only individuals alive right now are in captive propagation.
And they were at your facility at DLNR?
They were at our facility at DLNR, and they are now at the Bishop Museum and at the Honolulu Zoo here in their new lab.
Okay, and tell us why we have so many of them that we can spread them around.
Yeah, so I'm actually here with Mike Hatfield, a professor from the University of Hawaii, and in 1997, his crew collected seven wild snails to found a captive colony at the University of Hawaii. So they've been in captivity for decades now, and their population has gone up and down and up and down through the years, and we're at a point now where it's reached exponential growth, which is really cool to talk about. We have about 4,000 in captivity right now, and we get about 100 born a week, which is kind of insane considering their life history and how slow they reproduce and how long it takes for them to mature. Having 100 a week is an incredible achievement.
And so, Mike, I don't know, these are like your grandchildren?
Or great, something like that, right. Well, you know, we had been doing surveys the whole summit of the Ko'ola, and the Waianae for that matter. And we had marked populations because that was in the era when we didn't really know how long lived they were, how soon they matured, how many keiki they produced per year, and things like that. And so we had all these marked populations in the field, and we were seeing them go away, right? They were vanishing. So that's why I started the Captive Snail Lab. And lila was not the first snails we brought in there. And in fact, as Dave said, the populations went up and then at times down. We actually have some good genetic studies done on these because I was so afraid with only seven snails, they would be inbred. But as Dave has proven, they're remarkably hardy. There were two species in that field site when we were studying, so Akatanella lila and Akatanella sauerbiana. When Dave was a grad student, another grad student contemporary with him was actually doing studies there on movement in the snails, planting little antennae on them and tracking them with harmonic radar to see how far they went from original bushes. So it was an important site. And I was shocked when Dave first told me there were none left there. I really was, because it was kind of the heart of what was left. We had seen beautiful populations of lila, all deep green shells in the north, and we watched those disappear. And this was almost all Euglandina, the predatory snail.
And these snails were where? Where did you get these seven?
From the very site where Dave had established then one of the big predator exposure fences. So up at the top of Poamoho Trail and a bit to the north of that. A place that is in the records as north of the slide, because there had been a landslide, and on the summit trail, you had to sort of get around that. So it was just, you know, an easy place. You could tell other people north of the slide, and they knew what you were talking about.
And David, you had mentioned that you went back and looked in the records.
Actually, in 1997, Mike had collected the founders for our large lab population. And then it had been monitored by various entities over the years, from Mike's students to the Army Natural Resources Program. And then when Division of Forestry and Wildlife established the Snail Extinction Prevention Program, we started monitoring those populations. And unfortunately, by the time we built up our captive rearing efforts, got equipment and went up to go collect more, we could find only three snails left. And we spent hundreds of person hours combing this forest patch trying to find any last ones. So the entire world population of Akatsinella lila comes from seven collected in 1997 and three brought in 2018, which I say this with much sadness, I think those are the last three truly wild ones anyone will ever see, probably.
But to know that they have been able to reproduce, tell us again how many we have from those seven?
So we have around 4,000 right now, and we're getting about 100 a week born in captivity, which is incredible because they're long-lived. So they can live, you know, 15, 20 years if they're really healthy. They take about 5 years to reach sexual maturity, and then they only give birth to 1 to 7 babies a year, depending on the individual snail and the species, but they're just reproduce incredibly slowly. So getting them to this point where we can have so many that they can be distributed to different entities and released back into the wild now, it took decades, but we're at that point now, and it's a good model for species that aren't quite as far along in their conservation journey.
And so, Mike, I don't know, how does that make you feel when you know your seven are now 4,000?
Well, of course, it makes me feel great, you know. I mean, I feel terrible that they're gone in the field. That's sort of heartbreaking because we worked so hard. All the stuff Dave's been telling you about the life histories of these, when we started up there, we didn't know it. And the snails had been so abundant when people first started going up there. I mean, the descriptions are just sort of breathtaking. You sort of calculate there would be 1,000 snails in a single tree here and there. And so everybody assumed, well, you know, there they go. And the shell collectors, of course, who really hit them hard in the 1800s and first part of the 1900s, and what they would do is go to a population and collect all those beautiful adults and bring them out and kill them and take the shells, and all they kept were the shells. So it was looking back at records and then doing our long-term mark recapture studies, which is the way you find out how long, how fast they grow and how long it takes them to mature and how many keiki they have per year. We had to work with single marked populations on 5 by 5 meter quadrats where we would go in there monthly or every couple months, pull out all the snails, give them individual names, A21, measure them in a couple of dimensions and put them back. And then you go back and find A21 over and see how big it is. And the tree snails are cool that they tell you when they're mature. So they hit a maximum size and they put this big thick lip on the shell. And that's really when they start producing keiki. So that's what we learned. There was going to be a long row to do that in the lab. We knew it was going to take a lot of time. And of course, so what it's taken now is all this time, and now Dave has this wonderful success going there. And every species we looked at, here we looked at the similar ones on Molokai particularly, and they were doing the same thing, slow growth, late reproduction, low birth rate. So they evolved in a beautiful set of islands with no predators at all, as far as we could ever tell. And so they could have this sort of lackadaisical life cycle.
When they lose their habitat, that's when we start to worry.
Yeah, well, the habitat, of course, was disappearing when people chopped down the big trees for ship spars and took out the sandalwood for shipment to China and released cows and horses and pigs and goats and whatever that ate so much of the understory, introduced all the junk vegetation that the snails don't like. So the forest was pretty badly damaged too. So, and then the predators. The Hawaiian canoes brought the Polynesian rat. The first ships that came in brought in the two European rat species. They all ate snails. Then the Department of Agriculture in the 1950s started releasing deliberate snail predators, yeah? And so, those are what really then hit the snail, were the three rats and the rosy wolf snail. And then, of course, Ad Jackson's chameleons in the 1970s. So there was a point in my life where I thought, well, you know, because the snails will all be gone, there's a time when we can take snails from that lab and release them because there'll be these deserts and the predators won't get there. That was a dream. They just go wave after wave after wave, and it turns out there's more species of wolf snails than we thought. And so I think the situation in the field is hopeless.
But we do have a bright spot because we've got enough of the lilas that we may take them out again.
Well, how many species, Dave? A lot more than lilas.
We actually have over 40 species in captivity right now within this collective, the Bishop Museum, the zoo, and DLNR. And the complement to the captive rearing is some tools that we're implementing in the field to keep them around, and that's the use of predator-proof fencing. And this design was one that Mike brought back from Tahiti, from a fence design that they were working on there to protect some snails. And then the Army Natural Resources Program here on Oahu really advanced the barriers and everything that we use. And so the model of this fence that we use now comes from the Army Natural Resources Program. And it's made of it's a solid wall barrier. It's made with plastic lumber and plastic lining. So it's really resistant to UV radiation and weathering from water and wind. And the fence is pretty tall. It's about 6 feet tall. It's got this big curved hood that keeps rats out and Jackson's chameleons. And then it's got a little gauntlet for rosy wolf snails, including a little skirt, angled skirt, that the wolf snails get stuck. And if they get over that, we electrocute them with some electrical lines. We're actually building these on almost all islands right now. We've got projects on Big Island, Maui, Molokai, Oahu, where we're building these fence units to put snails that are reared in captivity back out into the wild. They are small and it's still a stopgap measure, but it allows them to stay on the landscape in large numbers and be protected from predators. And one cool thing is when you come to the Honolulu Zoo Lab, you can see a replica of the fence and actually interact with it, which is pretty cool. It's not electrified though, so it won't shock you.
People can come here to the zoo, go to Bishop Museum, and see conservation in action.
Yeah, and that's what's really neat about the lab. It's not a typical exhibit where you're just looking at animals. It's actually a lab that's behind the glass, a functioning laboratory. And so if you're lucky and you get here when the animals are being worked with, you'll be able to see the care in action and what it takes.
Okay, and I know we've got a room full of children that are eagerly waiting to come in and see this lab.
That was David Sisko and Mike Hatfield, who we talked to last week at the opening of the Honolulu Zoo's newest exhibit space focusing on native snails. Sisko says there is more good news to come. The state is soon to release some of the rare and endangered snails that it's been rearing in the lab back out in the forest, so stay tuned. Well, we've got to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to check in on the Japanese visitor market as tourism numbers are soft, closing out the year. Leave us your feedback on our TalkBack line or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.